Today on Pilgrim Radio's His People, Nathaniel Jeanson, searching for the fascinating history of Native Americans.
You have in North America, we know from archaeology, there's a Hopewell culture. They build earthen mounds. The epicenter is just north of me here in Ohio, and you can visit them. They're UNESCO sites. They fall right about the same time this genetic lineage comes in, and then there's the last migration is what gives rise to the Delaware. They came across the Bering Strait with their relatives like the Blackfeet, the Cheyenne, and others. They're part of the what's known as the Algic language family. That migration from Central Asia about 900s AD. And so there's constant flux. It's a very dynamic history. Lots of connections to East and Northeast Asia.
Nathaniel Jeanson next. Dr. Nathaniel Jeanson, a research biologist, speaker, and author with Answers in Genesis, says he's always known there was something off about the history of North America. Using DNA and other tools, he found that Native American peoples suffered a profound population collapse as high as 90% after European contact. It's a fascinating project, and he writes about it in They Had Names, Tracing the History of the North American Indigenous Peoples. Dr. Jeanson, you're a research biologist, so what prompted you to want to look deeply into American and specifically Native American history?
I'd say there were several motivations in terms of pragmatic motivations that relate to my work. I had published the book Traced, Human DNA's Big Surprise in March of 2022, which looked at the DNA history for peoples around the globe. And I spent about a year developing a network of contacts through a series of YouTube videos after the publication of that book. And at some point, it hit me thinking, Ken Ham probably wants me to publish another book at some point so I could advance the ball in each of these regions the rest of my life, and I'd have a lot of fun doing it, but I might not have anything to show for it. So I probably should pick something I can bring to conclusion. And focusing on North America, it would be a lot easier, it seemed, at that time for a number of reasons. It's English speaking, so if you go to primary sources and such, I don't have to use a translator or learn a new language. The contacts to be made that I'd like to make are all within driving distance or easy flying distance. I don't have to go across the Atlantic or to China to try to advance the ball in that sense. And a good place as well to, if we're going to start testing more DNA, to work out the bugs, I guess, close to home where it's not, you know, do I have to ship the sample across the Atlantic and is it going to survive? No, it's right here. So that was one reason for going that direction. Of course, you can have the best of intentions and not find out anything. So another reason was we actually made some discoveries along these lines and the pieces were coming together. So that there was another reason to go the direction of North American indigenous history. And really, I guess you could say, and here's an apologetic point, it wasn't just we were making discoveries, but discoveries within the Young Earth framework. That's a key plank in this entire adventure, is we're now at a new stage in creation science where instead of watching our opponents receive $45 billion annually from the NIH, let's say, to do their research, they find a lost city in the jungle, they publish a headline, the AP publishes a headline, and then we react to it. We, despite not having $45 billion annually to fund research with a generous donation, donations from our supporters, much smaller budget, we've been able to make advances and make news. That's really the biggest headline from this book, is we're now making news, making discoveries. This isn't just Indians in the Bible. This is, we've made discoveries no one else has. So that's one side of it. There's a professional side to it. There's a personal side to it. So I grew up knowing nothing about pre-Columbian North America, pre-European North America, pre-Pilgrim North America. And so it's always been bothersome, really, on two counts for me. One, we grew up in school learning European history, Western civilization history. And you come back to the United States, you kind of just look to your left or to your right and say, okay, North America, Pilgrims, that's where we start. Well, what about before the Pilgrims? And I just never had any answers. And secondly, I grew up in two cultures. My mother's German, so we went to Germany regularly every year, where my grandparents came here. And being in Europe, and we travel too, you can't miss the fact that there's old cathedrals, old castles everywhere you turn that go back to the Middle Ages, or I've been to Italy, go back to the time of Christ or earlier. And then you come back to the United States and, okay, where are we going to go? Plymouth Plantation, that's one of the oldest sites. Or, again, you're stuck with this big void of, where is the history? There has to be a backstory to the Native Americans, how many boys like me grew up playing Cowboys and Indians, something like that. Not that necessarily a good thing. It's just there's always this fascination, but there's always this big blank. And so it's been very personally satisfying to be able to dig into this and say, oh, this is what happened. This is the backstory to the Wampanoag or the Narragansett, the Massachusetts, the first Thanksgiving. Now we can finally fill in and understand my home, because this is where I was born and raised, in the United States, in Wisconsin. Now I can know what transpired here and own it and gain respect for it.
And you make a statement, I think, somewhere toward the beginning of your book, that in terms of Native American history, you always knew or sensed that something was off about it?
Exactly. And it's that void of not being able to say anything except, okay, the Lakota Sioux were out in the wild, on the Great Plains, in the Wild West, in the 1800s, and maybe we'd be able to say something like, but even this was news to me, we could say something like they came out of Minnesota maybe in the 1600s and went onto the plains, but that's still post-Pilgrims, basically. So what happened before then? Where were they before then? And they're just decades. I had nothing to fill in the blank, and it just bothered me. So that's the sentiment I've had for a long time, and it's really only come together in the last 5 years. Again, it's not just that we did research and we didn't have to offend Genesis or offend biblical sensibilities. No, the 4,500-year timescale back to Noah has been an essential scientific tool to uncover the mystery, to find the genetic answers. The genetic answers then confirm the indigenous histories, and that really just snowballed from there into a comprehensive history.
Now, a phrase that you use, or I suppose it's a word, it's hyphenated, but you refer to pre-contact history of the Native American peoples. What does that mean?
Contact, I'm just referring to when Europeans first permanently open up a bridge, basically, between the old world and the new. Yes, Vikings landed in what's now Canada in the 1000s, but that was very brief. Not sure they had any sort of permanent, I mean, they left some archaeological ruins, but in terms of a permanent presence, there wasn't much that came of it. Post-contact is essentially post-Columbus. Well, if you're thinking North America, Columbus, of course, is 1492, and he's in the Caribbean. But if you think about sort of the lower 48 states, we're talking Jamestown, Pilgrim, 1600s. So pre-contact would be anything before then, before Jamestown, before the Pilgrims, before we have some sort of European records to say what happened. And post-contact, anything thereafter. So I grew up knowing lots of post-contact. U.S. history, of course, I had a class in high school on that, and that involves Louisiana Purchase and Manifest Destiny. And of course, you're going to be talking about the Native tribes that they encountered. I was homeschooled, so we had lots of fun learning about Native ways and diets and contact. And what boy doesn't like to learn about weapons and war paint and moccasins and all that stuff? But again, the pre-Pilgrims, the pre-contact era, we had nothing.
Well, the book is They Had Names, Tracing the History of the North American Indigenous People. My guest is the author, Dr. Nathaniel Jeanson. He's a research biologist with Answers in Genesis. Well, so you wanted to find out, or as much as you could, begin to learn about the history, pre-contact history, prior to the contact with the European Americans, of the Native Americans. Where did you begin? I mean, do many of the Native American peoples have written histories?
To the latter question, the answer is yes and no. Many of them are oral histories, but they were written down in some cases in the late 1800s, early 1900s. Those are some of the primary sources I'm relying on, by ethnologists. So part of U.S. history, as the U.S. expands westward, the U.S. government sent representatives out to the various tribes and nations to write down, basically give us a report of who these people are, what are their cultures like, what are their diets, all this meticulous detail that will fill books that are now publicly available online. Copyright's expired. You can get the PDFs. That's how I got it. But oftentimes, and it varies from tribe to tribe, there might be one line. Well, we came from the West. Okay. That might not seem like much, but when you can connect them to other tribes by language or by DNA, now that becomes a puzzle piece that fits into a larger picture. Or sometimes you'll have a whole paragraph. Really, what's one of the backbone documents for the book, and this is, as far as I can tell, a fairly rare exception, is a written document by the Delaware Indians called the Red Record, or the Wallum Olam. If you look online, you'll find out that I think it's the Oklahoma Band of the Delaware, one of them in the Plains area, has officially rejected it as authentic because of a 1995 thesis by David McCutcheon, who said this document, the Red Record, the Wallum Olam, the supposed history of the Delaware, that was forged by a Kentuckian in the early 1800s. Well, what I found, and this is really how I got into it in the first place, and really what opened up a whole new world for information and history, was I was doing genetic research, and the genetic research lined up with this red record, this Wollum Olam, and that's where I said, aha, this can't be a forgery. I mean, if you're really good in the 1800s, I'm sure you can write something that's persuasive and believable. But can you write a document in 1832, let's say, that anticipates genetic discoveries a century and a half, 2 centuries later in the future? That's hard to believe. So only real histories can do that, because real histories will line up with the genetics, both record the facts of what happened. And so that's where I said, this has to be a real history. And if you think about it, and this is how I reflected on it, if the mainstream community got this document so wrong, how many other documents have they gotten wrong? And so my default assumption now is, if I find an indigenous history, for example, some of these records written down by the ethnologist, late 1800s, early 1900s, I default to assume it's true unless we have good evidence otherwise. And I have some Native American contacts who've cautioned me with certain authors saying, well, this guy we know, he went to, let's say, the Navajo, or he went to the Cherokee, and he would give all the kids candy. So of course, children will tell you anything you want to hear if you give them candy. But there were other guys who were much more meticulous, careful in writing down. Maybe they'll speak to the elders. Those sorts of things. There are criteria I'll use to make sure, sift the wheat from the chaff. But this has opened up a dramatic new window into the past, and this red record. So the red record describes, really the core of it is a series of sachems. It's a list of sachems. That's their name for leader, like ruler, sachem. And they'll give a line or two. So-and-so was the sachem. They'll name him. And we started farming. So-and-so was the sachem, and he fought these enemies over here. And so we left and moved west. You can reconstruct a very detailed migration across the Bering Strait into Alaska, down the western coast of Canada, across the Great Plains. One of the key battles they describe was the greatest battle in all pre-contact, pre-European history of North America. At St. Louis, we can see the ruins of this now. If you go to the site today, you'll hear the mainstream explanation, which frankly is quite boring and uninteresting. I mean, people came, they had families, they planted crops, and they left. Well, every people group on earth does that, so what? I can say, with genetics, with this indigenous history, with language, I know who was here. It was the Delaware, or the ancestors of the Delaware. They asked for passage across the Mississippi. There was an empire based at St. Louis, Cahokia, that had an empire all across the southeast, and they slaughtered the Delawares initially. The Delawares got allies together with probably the Sioux and Catawbans, like the Osage and Ponca and Omaha and such. Together they defeated the Natchez. That's the sort of narrative now we can tell, we've been able to uncover, thanks to this combination of data, which again, the hero of this discovery story is the Young Earth timescale. For me, it began with, let's understand genetics within a Young Earth framework. How is human history stamped in our DNA? And being able to find that link, and actually started with the post-European arrival history. And once I was able to work out those details, then I could work backwards in time. And after DNA discoveries were made, okay, oh, this now confirms an indigenous history. Okay, the indigenous history lines up with linguistics and language comparison. Oh, and now this explains archaeology. And that's how it snowballed from there. And resulted in now a fairly detailed play-by-play akin to what we learned for Europe. For me, Europe, the reference point is, I have a textbook, I've got a bunch of maps that show how kingdoms rise and fall, the Roman Empire, then the Middle Ages, you got the Vikings, and I have names of rulers. We're all bored by them in school about the European monarchs and the French monarch, and I don't care which Henry this is, but that's right. Now what we can be able to do for the North American continent, which is a huge advance over just, well, someone was here, I don't know what happened, but there must be an explanation, and we move on. We don't have to move on. We can now study this in detail, and there's a great series of events we now have with heroes and names and winners and losers.
Well, there's so much detail in your book. They had names tracing the history of the North American indigenous people. How far back can their history be traced? In other words, can you trace it back to a point of actually arrival in America?
Yes. And it's what makes it so fascinating to me is how, in one sense, unexpected and expected it is. So the mainstream view is 15,000 years ago, there was a single migration into the Americas across the Bering Strait, and then people spread out rapidly and for lack of a better description. They just sat there for 14,500 years until Columbus arrived, which that's unlike anywhere else on the planet. I mean, you learn the history of civilization in the Middle East and Europe, and there's constant change, movement, fighting. One people rises, another people falls. And somehow, in the Americas, none of that happened, it seems, until at the very end, you know, the Aztecs in Mexico, the Incas in South America. That's how it comes across. In this case now, and they're... Again, this is an ongoing research project, and they had names. The book is, well, here's where we're at right now, with more to be discovered. How far back we can go kind of depends on the tools. So with archaeology, we can go back to the earliest times. With genetics, I can trace, we have the ability now to trace any people group on Earth, including Native American groups, back to specific sons of Noah. So I can unravel step by step where they came from, who they came from. In terms of how it all played out here, because again, anywhere else on Earth, there's migrations. There's people who move. One people rises, another people falls. Same thing played out here. And I can tell you now, the book went to press earlier this year, and I have a paper coming out next month, or this month actually, later this month, where I was able to make some new discoveries. So combining that together, there were at least 5 settlings of the Americas, 5 different settlings. So Mesoamerica is a key tool here. We tend to, in my mind, growing up, Mexico, Guatemala, all that was somehow different and not related to what was going on up here with the Lakota and the Choctaw and the Chickasaw and the Delaware and such. But they were connected. The native accounts themselves talk about connections. Anyway, so the first migration gives rise to, as best I can tell, the Olmecs in Mexico. They built these giant sculpted heads. You can still see them in museums in Mexico. The next wave of migrants happens about 1000 BC. So the Olmecs are probably the first migrants after the Tower of Babel. Then you have the ancestors of the Maya arriving about 1000 BC. I can see that genetically. You can see that archaeologically, a rise in Mayan civilization in the Guatemalan lowlands about 1000 BC. This is all still Mesoamerica, but I'll get to North America in a minute. In 100 BC, there was another migration. All of these are from East Asia, so this is implicit, in a sense, refutation of the Book of Mormon, because there's no migrations I've seen genetically, and I can go all the way back to 1000 BC. None seem to trace back to ancient Israel. They're all East, Northeast Asia, or Central Asia. So 1000 BC is about the time that the biggest city in all the Americas rises, Teotihuacan, just northeast, I think, of modern Mexico City. That rises about 100 BC. And then, and here's where I get into what I talk about in the book, what really rocked the Americas was when we had an invasion about the 300s to 600s AD. So that, just to have a reference point, in the old world, in Europe around the time of Christ, you have the Roman Empire, of course. That's the context in which Jesus is born.
Mm-hmm.
And the Roman Empire falls due to invasions from the east about the 400s AD. It's Germanic tribes, but also the Huns from Central Asia. Not really well known, lots of questions about them, but they were a martial people. They had all sorts of destruction in Europe. Their relatives also went across the Bering Strait into the Americas, wreaked all sorts of havoc here. Teotihuacan, that great city of 200,000 people, falls right at this time, violently destroyed. You have in North America, we know from archaeology, there's a Hopewell culture. They built earthen mounds. The epicenter is just north of me here in Ohio, and you can visit them. They're UNESCO sites. They fall right about the same time this genetic lineage comes in. And then there's the last migration is what gives rise to the Delaware. They came across the Bering Strait with their relatives like the Blackfeet, the Cheyenne, and others. They're part of what's known as the Algic language family. That migration from Central Asia about 900s AD, and so there's constant flux. It's a very dynamic history. Lots of connections to East and Northeast Asia, and we have the best data for the last few centuries before contact. That's where the Delaware count gives us this play-by-play. We have less data then for between the 900s and 300s AD, and then it gets a little bit more murky before that point. But again, research is ongoing. I just made a discovery that'll open up more windows into that. Dim period of the past, but very exciting and a lot, way more than I ever had growing up and learned in school.
What can you share what that discovery is?
The discovery being, okay, so for they had names, what I rely on genetically there heavily, the main tool I used there, as well as in my previous book, Traced, was the male inherited Y chromosome. And this is a record, obviously, just of men, fathers pass on Y chromosomes to their sons. You don't get the female side. And the reason I stuck to the Y chromosome was the statistics of the female inherited DNA, this is known as mitochondrial DNA, were just so bad, I couldn't make heads or tails of it. So for example, even though it's passed on from mothers to daughters, mothers pass it on to sons as well, just then it stops with you and me because we're men and we don't pass it on. But we can still have our mitochondrial DNA tested. If you and I compare ours, let's say we have a common ancestor, 8,500. The statistical uncertainty for mitochondrial DNA is 1,000 years either way. So great, we have an ancestor at 500 AD, or it might have been 500 BC in the time of the ancient Greeks, or it could possibly have been the 1500s AD in the time of the Middle Ages. It just, you know, late Middle Ages. It just, how can you make any sense of that? It just, you can't connect it to anything useful historically. Whereas with the Y chromosome, if you and I each had our Y chromosomes tested, the result said 500 AD, it might be an uncertainty of 100 or 200 years either way. So now I can be much more precise and say, okay, I think it was a Roman ancestor we were connected to, or maybe it was the Huns we were connected to, or maybe it's a Germanic tribe we're connected to. That's the level of precision. I was finally able to crack that code, solve the mitochondrial DNA problem, the statistics, and this is the paper that's coming out this month later, showing that now we have a way to solve the statistics, and the mitochondrial DNA for Native Americans is what shows these additional migrations that I had no access to before. It was a mystery that bothered me. It was really one of the main arguments you could have advanced against my view is, okay, the oldest genetic lineages I had talked about in the book go back to the 300s AD. Well, we've got archaeology that goes back long before that. How do you explain that discrepancy? And so what I had been saying was, well, whoever came in must have wiped out who was here before. Now I can add to it and say, well, the men were wiped out largely, which tends to be true historically. The men come in, the warriors get destroyed, and then the ladies are taken, the children are taken. And that's what seems to have happened here is you see the female lineages preserved, but not the male ones. And now we can tell much more of the history of all the Americas with genetics in a comprehensive way. And it opens up lots of possibilities beyond that into the rest of the world. So that's been very exciting for me and solves one of the things even this new book, They Had Names, doesn't address, because that's just where the research was at 6 months ago. So
and
research moves on.
And as you say, science is always, it's a discipline that deals with the present. All you know is what is now, and it's always subject to revision depending upon evidence that comes to your attention.
Exactly. And that point is what's kind of made me laugh in my 15 years as a professional creation scientist, because what's the main argument against creation science? Well, science says this, and therefore the Bible's wrong. And I'm like, science says this today and something else tomorrow. And even I tend to hesitate sometimes with giving conclusions or wanting to be very aggressive or forceful in what I say, because it might change tomorrow. And so then you're going to have egg on your face. Or it shows the foolishness of basing any sort of faith on what's in science. It's a helpful confirmation, but you have to realize it's simultaneously both a very weak and powerful way of knowing the world. It's powerful, we're using technology thanks to science right now, microphones and internet and all that sort of stuff, radio.
Yep.
But at the same time, there's so many things we don't know or that we've gotten wrong in times past with science. And so to try to determine absolute truth, transcendental things, transcendent things about the world, good luck, essentially. And what a foolish thing to do, to say, I'm going to base my eternity on what the headlines say tomorrow, because, I mean, a year from now, the headlines are going to say something different. So it's been helpful for me to gain that perspective and to have the proper weight and know what proper weight to give to science and thinking about these larger philosophical and religious questions.
I did want to ask you, and I know our time is going very quickly, to have a few other questions, but one was, there was a profound population collapse among the Native American peoples after European contact, and my only knowledge of that is, was it the introduction of diseases that they brought, or why was that?
Yes, good question, and this was a key plank for me chronologically to unravel all this history. Just to sort of answer your question and put it in the context of my own story, I moved to Kentucky in 2015. We have a town of 20,000 people, but it's got a great local library. One of the books they had in the history section was this book by Charles Mann, 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus. He's not a creationist, but a very fascinating discussion he had about this question of how many people were here on the eve of Columbus's arrival. That's been heavily debated and heavily, another example of science changing, dramatic change from 50 years ago, where the view back then was the Americas were sparsely populated, there was hardly anyone here, sort of this kumbaya, everyone's hugging the trees, and these big bad Europeans come in and change all that. And he shows, and he's a reporter, so he's reporting what the mainstream scientific community has been concluding, which is, number one, there were sort of a middle of the road estimate was 50 to 60 million people here in 1491. For perspective, in Europe, the 1300s saw the Black Death. It whacked anywhere from 33% to 50% of the European population, so that in 1400, all of Europe had a population of just 60 million people. And so all the Americas had 50 to 60 million people. Again, at some times in the past, they had a city of 200,000, Teotihuacan. So this is a very populous place. You had civilizations here, lots going on. They're transforming their environment. And then Europeans arrive. Yes, I think one of the primary causes was disease. Foreign diseases they didn't have resistance to that wiped so many of them out. There's also battles, enslavements. A lot of that's going on so that in the centuries following, for about three centuries following Columbus's arrival, 80 to 90% of the population disappears. Some have begun to recover. Just to give an example closer to home, Navajo, from their own website, will say there were about only 9,000, 10,000 Navajo left in the late 1800s. U.S. Census in 2010 says there's now about 400,000. So they've made a significant recovery. And that's sort of a general pattern you'll see, and it varies, of course, from place to place, but you'll see that in the Americas. And finding the genetic smoking gun of that event, of the massive collapse, was the key finding for me, as well as the recovery after the collapse, to be able to say, okay, this is how DNA has history stamped on it. Here's how we know we're on the right track. And that gave me the confidence to then start using DNA to look before Columbus to see what happened. And that's where some of these major revelations and revolutionary ideas came from about multiple settlings and such. It's driven by the genetics, and the genetics is anchored in being able to detect the fact of the population collapse and recovery after European arrival.
Well, the book is They Had Names, Tracing the History of the North American Indigenous People. And I have to ask you this, Dr. Jeanson, what is the biblical significance of your research, or why should it be of interest to believers?
For believers, it represents a massive monumental shift in the creation evolution debate. In times past, we've been very reactive to what the evolutionists have said. They make a claim, well, hold on, wait, here's how things really are. This is now a massive reversal of roles where creationists are taking the lead. We're breaking news now, and the evolutionists will have to do what we've done to them. They're going to have to look at the headlines we're writing and say, well, hold on, not so fast. Here's the assumptions you're making. And it's a wonderful time to be a creation scientist and to be able to make discoveries. And I've already seen, I think, practical fruits of this. So what would it look like now if creationists are in the lead and people have to look to us for, oh, did you find a lost city, or what's the latest discovery? It forces non-Christians to sit up and pay attention. So we've done a number of YouTube videos. You can go to our Answers in Genesis YouTube channel. Lots of playlists. They Had Names as a playlist. Lost History of North America as a playlist. I've had a number of Native Americans contact me. Maybe the highlight for me was being invited to the Lakota Treaty Council Conference. So the Lakota Sioux, one of the most famous tribes of the Great Plains, Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse. These are Lakota. They have an annual three-day conference. This was in Rapid City, South Dakota, December 2023. Very indigenous. It was a very indigenous worldview experience for me, non-Christian. I had to pinch myself because I was one of the few Caucasians there, and I was thinking, aside from this research, we have nothing in common. Why did they invite me? Very resistant to outsiders, and I think the answer is because the research I'm doing is validating some of their own indigenous histories. The mainstream evolutionary explanation cannot do that, and so now it's bringing people to us who would normally have nothing to do with us, and they're having to listen to what's going on. This is what happens when creation science takes the lead, is that it allows us to go on offense. And if you look at the YouTube views, this is not patting myself on the back as much as here's, I think, evidence of there's more than just creationists now paying attention. We're filling a void that no one has been able to do up till now, and no one will be able to do because they don't have the Young Earth timescale. Some of the videos have gone viral. Again, people have contacted me based on their language. I would say some of them are definitely not Christians. And I've had someone say basically verbatim, you know, I don't like that Bible stuff, but I think you're onto something. And that to me is a testament of when you take the Bible at face value, when you take what God has said and you start doing science within that framework, answers begin to emerge. It's almost like shooting fish in a barrel. And this now starts scratching an itch that both Christians and non-Christians alike have wondered about. So it's usually significant for the debate because this is exactly what the evolutionists have demanded of us for 40 years. Why isn't creation science taught in public schools? Supposedly because creationists don't do science in the technical form of this, is that we don't make testable predictions, they would say. This represents the fulfillment of predictions I've made prior. It's bona fide science. It collapses the legal foundation for keeping creation science at the public schools. So it's massive in its implications for creationists, for Bible believers, and it portends, I think, the dawn of a new era in this debate.
You've been listening to His People on Pilgrim Radio. Many thanks to our guest, Dr. Nathaniel Jeanson. He's a research biologist, speaker, and author with Answers in Genesis. His new book is titled, They Had Names, Tracing the History of the North American Indigenous Peoples. You can contact him by going to answersingenesis.org. Thanks for listening, and I hope you can join us again on Monday at the same time for another edition of His People.